hello, welcome back to Loki's Library, and if you are new here, welcome. I am your librarian, Katrina, and this is where I am reading through the enormous library of books that you see behind me, and then I give you a quick synopsis and tell you what I think about them. So if you like books, just aren't sure what to read next, hit that subscribe button, like and share my videos, and let me know what you think in the comments. This week's book of the week was one of those random finds at my favorite local bookstore. Yes, I shop local as often as I can, making this week's book of the week The Immortal Irishman, The Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero by Timothy Egan. The accompanying cocktail is actually a rare find. It's actually named in direct relation to the man in question, not just something that's like tangential to him. But he was apparently there. I don't know. It's a legend. It's an urban legend. But hey, it worked. It's the 69th Irish Regimental Cocktail. It is one part Irish whiskey and three parts of champagne. So let's do this. This book is about one of the more remarkable men to come out of the 19th century, Thomas Francis Marr, and it's spelled M-E-A-G-H-E-R. The author kindly and helpfully provided that it is pronounced Marr, who lived on three continents, fought in two wars, and died a mystery in Montana. So here is the story. Thomas Francis Marr was born August 3rd, 1823, in Waterford, Ireland, and he was born to one of the wealthier families in Ireland, the family having made its money as tradesmen in Newfoundland before returning to the ancestral home in Ireland. Now, there are actually no real directions on this cocktail, so I'm just kind of doing the three parts to the one part. I poured it over ice because I think it's likely there was ice present when the cocktail was created, but there's no real guarantee of that. Ooh, check it out. I barely had enough, so I don't have to open up my spare bottle of a tiny champagne. The author does an absolutely amazing job of breaking down just what it meant to be Irish in Ireland in the 19th century. And it does not mean what it meant to be, say, American in America in the 19th century. Or to be perfectly fair and intellectually honest, it does not mean what it meant to be white American in the 19th century. Trust me, that distinction is really relevant to the story. Being Irish in Ireland in the 19th century meant you were not even really a second-class citizen in your own country, more like a distant third behind the English landlords and property owners, and the English lords. The English held dominance over basically the entire island, with English property owners and lords being those first and class second citizens, and even the wealthy Irish were a distant third, and like, God help you if you were born poor Irish, you were completely expendable in your own country. This, incidentally, is one of the reasons why, so many nations, I forget the number, but there's a lot of countries on this planet who celebrate Independence Day, with the independence being from Great Britain. Ireland is one of them. That's not directly part of this story, although he certainly laid the groundwork for that to happen. Now, Marr, given that his family was wealthy, did get himself a gentleman's education, one of the best schools in Ireland, and that he attended that, and then when he, Clonsdown, and when he was kicked out of that, he went to England for a proper education there at Stonyhurst. I forget who else went there. There was another very famous author who's like highlighted in the book who went there. Doesn't matter. When he completed his education before returning to Ireland to be one of her most favorite sons. And he truly was blessed with the Irish gift of gab and Irish luck. He became involved in the Young Ireland movement very early on. Like almost from the inception of the movement. He was born in 23. The Young Ireland movement started in 1840. So he was, 17? And he was there basically from the inception. He became a political author and a public speaker. And when the potato famine hit Ireland, he became a loud voice against English tyranny. And understand, this tyranny had been going on for literally hundreds of years, going back to like the 11th century with the first rounds of English suppression culminating in the Kilkenny Laws that forbade the English from marrying the Irish. If they did marry, then no child of that union could inherit property in Ireland or England. So they, forced them even lower on the social status for, having for miscegenation, basically, the mixing of bloodlines. And the island literally belonged to the English, in case you were wondering why there was so much phenomenal hatred between the two neighboring nations, even into the 21st century. Let's try this. That is not shabby. That is not too shabby. It's like a less sweet apple juice, actually. It kind of reminds me of apple juice, but it's not like overwhelmingly sweet like a lot of commercial apple juices are. It's pretty tasty. Now, the soil of Ireland is incredibly fertile, and Ireland was essentially the breadbasket of Great Britain, being used to grow fields of wheat, barley, and rye, No corn. Corn was a Native American crop. In fact, corn was actually sent over to try and help the Irish with during the famine, and they couldn't digest it. They just didn't have the evolutionary mechanisms in place to properly digest corn. They didn't digest it. But the pasture land was used to feed large herds of sheep and cattle. But all of this, the crops, the sheep, the cattle, they belonged to the English landlords. So the Irish, in order to maximize food for the home table, grew potatoes. Now, potatoes are another crop that is not native to Ireland, but the Irish were able to digest it quite easily. And when it was imported to Ireland from the Americas several hundred years earlier, when the English started setting ships across the Atlantic, grows very well in Ireland. That catch-all root crop actually, like as little as an acre of planted potatoes could feed a family of four with zero nutritional deficits, because potatoes are actually an incredibly healthy food. Now, what we do to potatoes is not so healthy, you know, the deep frying it and, you know, oils and stuff, but the potatoes themselves are very healthy. And so the Irish were more or less healthy. They didn't have like scurvy or anything like that, because potatoes, very good for you. Until 1845. When blight struck and decimated the potato crops. And this led to the first round of famine. Hundreds of thousands died of starvation. The horror of this is that, just like the Ukraine during the Holodomor, other crops grew exceptionally well, but the Irish barely counted as human. Rather than using the crops of growing wheat, barley, and rye to feed the native population, those crops were shipped out of country for cash, and the Irish were left to starve. This kind of contributed to the animosity between the Irish and the English. Now, this famine continued for the next 7 years. It was a 7-year blight. I mean, the Holodomor was, what, 4 years? So 7 years. The Irish planted potatoes and watched the crops rot in the soil from this blight that just never seemed to end. And the famine was absolutely infamous. I mean, this is the mid-19th century. This was well before internet, radio, TV, internet. I mean, even telegraph was barely a known thing at that point. And I think Morse code was invented in like 1837. So the fact that this made it out of Ireland and became international news tells you just how alarming this was. And international forces joined together to send aid to Ireland. All right. I mean, countries all over the world, the poorest of the poor, like the Choctaw Indians, that's quite famous. They were fresh off their own struggle from the Trail of Tears. They sent money to the Irish. India sent money to the Irish. India, which was struggling with its own boot of suppression with the English, sent money to help the Irish. And the United States sent food. They're like, hey, we're going to send food, feed the Irish, feed the people. And the English, in a spectacularly dickish move, blocked the aid from landing, claiming that giving food and money to the Irish would interfere with free markets. Now, I have not yet read Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. I have the book. I'm economic out for a little bit. So I actually was going to read that book this month, and I almost wish I had when I got to that part, because I was like, really? I feel like Adam Smith probably has some opinions on charity, and it doesn't mean to let the people starve. But what I do know about Adam Smith and laissez-faire is that anytime the government gets involved, bad things happen. That's basically what Adam Smith in a nutshell. Government gets involved, bad things happen. And that's it. That's in a nutshell. And the government directly interfered with these deliveries. And while they may have claimed it was keep the markets open, that clearly isn't the case, because it's not laissez-faire if the government gets involved. I think most likely the end goal was to kill as many Irish as they could. Just, you know, let God sort it out, basically. And it worked. By the time the famine ended, millions had starved to death, and millions more had immigrated to other parts of the planet, including America, where they began overrunning the tenements in the Five Points Bureau of New York City. Marr began using his incredibly powerful oration skills to compose essays and give public speeches, which were published in Young Irish publications. And he made his speeches, and he actually designed what would become Ireland's flag, sewing the three vertical bars of green, white, and orange silk that Ireland would later adopt as its own. Now, unbeknownst to the Young Ireland movement, which included the future mother of Oscar Wilde, incidentally, her pen name was Speranza. That was kind of cool to learn. They held a viper to their breast. It seems St. Patrick didn't drive all the snakes out of Ireland. The one that betrayed them all was one of their very own, John Donnellan Balfe, who began feeding information to the British about the Young Ireland movement, resulting in the arrest of the movement's leaders. And initially, they were all slated to hang for treason, but public pressure and other changes in political climate got them deported to the prison colony in Tasmania. Now, it's called something else in the book, because it wasn't Tasmania yet, it is now, so for easy reference, that's where he ended up, was Tasmania. And he spent several years there. He actually identified Balfe as the traitor who got them all arrested when Balfe showed up with a nice niche piece of land and a free man in Tasmania. It struck some chords, and he's like, wait a minute, that motherfucker betrayed us. And Balfe was basically a scorned man from then, like nobody would talk to him. While he was in Tasmania, he met and married his first wife, who was the daughter of another deportee. Although this one, I think her father was deported for robbery or like highwaymanship, like pulled over a stagecoach sort of thing. Now, ironically, even though they were all convicts, except for his wife, Catherine Bennett, Benny, she was born a free woman. She just happened to be born in Tasmania of a thief, not a political prisoner. So she was considered lower status. And his friends believed that Marr had married beneath himself. But he didn't think so. Don't get me wrong. I think he was very much in love with his wife. However, he also knew that agreeing to stay in prison when escape was a possibility, and he knew it was a possibility because one of his other Young Ireland compatriots had already managed to escape and made it all the way to San Francisco, where he was basically greeted as a hero. Marr decided he couldn't stay. He had to do everything he could to go out and live his life. He wasn't meant to be an inmate on this island forever. And by agreeing to stay and agreeing to maintain his parole, he was basically bowing to the yoke the English had placed on his neck. So after carefully laid plans, Marr revoked his own parole and escaped. Now, parole basically just meant that he gave his word as a gentleman that he would not attempt to escape. And the English used that to, like when he did escape, they were like, oh, well, he's clearly no gentleman. Well, what the fuck does he care if he's not a gentleman? He's free now. He can go and do what he wants. So he gave the English a few hours' notice that he was no longer going to honor that word, and then bugged out. He eventually made it to New York City, where he joined the Democrats at Tammany Hall. Now, this is not an odd choice. He landed in New York City in May 1852. The Republican Party did not exist yet. It wouldn't exist until 1856. They would field their first candidate would be John C. Fremont. The Irish in New York were almost all Democrats, because the Democrats welcomed them, and they absolutely controlled Tammany Hall. I mean, John Kelly famously was one of the biggest bosses of Tammany Hall. The other rising political party at that time, because the Whigs were on the out, the Know-Nothings. And they were extremely anti-immigration, especially anti-Irish immigration. And they got their names from basically starting fights and riots, and when questioned, would claim to know nothing about it. So they were called the Know-Nothing Party. And actually, several former presidents tried to run for candidacy on the Know-Nothing ticket when they were ousted from both the Whigs and the Democrats. I think Martin Van Buren, and I'm almost certain Fillmore, but it's been a while since I read their books, but the Know-Nothing Party was mentioned in several books because it was quite the rising political movement back in the day. So he joined the Democrats, but whereas quite a few of the immigrant Irish were openly and fully racist and agreed with segregation and slavery, mostly for psychological reasons, believe it or not. I mean, they may be the lowest social strata, being Irish and being immigrants, but hey, at least they were no longer slaves like they had been under the English. Marr's general take on the matter was that whether he agreed with it or not, slavery was legal in his adopted country. So while he may not own slaves of his own, he certainly didn't support it directly. It was legal, and so what were you going to do about it? And that was kind of his take on it. Allergies. Now, while in New York, Benny joined him by way of Ireland, where she got on very well with Marr Sr. And Benny and Marr Sr. came to New York, and while there, Benny became pregnant with their second child. She actually had been pregnant with their first when Marr escaped, but the baby didn't live long past birth, and so he was baptized, died, and buried in Tasmania. Benny, since she was born a free woman, was absolutely able to leave Tasmania as soon as she could book passage, and Marr Sr., who loved and supported his son, sent her passage and bought her boat ticket back to Ireland, basically. So she went to Ireland, the two of them came over to New York, saw the sights in New York before returning back to Ireland because she didn't like New York. I think she thought it was dirty or something like that. He says in the book specifically why she didn't. But she returned to Ireland with her father-in-law when he went home and was pregnant when the ship sailed. Now, sadly, she's the one who did not survive the next child's birth, leaving Marr's only child to survive to adulthood, Thomas Bennett Marr, in Ireland, and he would be raised by Marr's Irish relatives, and Marr would never ever meet his son. which is horribly sad. Following the death of his first wife, Marr would go on to meet the love of his life. Not that he didn't love Benny, I think he absolutely did, but his second wife, Elizabeth Libby Townsend, was his equal in intellect and passion. And she followed him everywhere, even onto the battlefield, followed him for the rest of his life, and was his equal in all ways. And if his friends thought that his first wife was beneath him, no one doubted that his second wife was well outside his league. I mean, she was way above his station. Because even though his father was rich, he was not, right? He was basically an escaped convict and a political refugee. Whereas she was the oldest daughter of a very wealthy Peter Townsend, who, as a Protestant and not a Democrat, I mean, I don't think he was a member of the Know-Nothings, but he didn't necessarily approve of the Tammany Hall either. But he did not approve of his daughter's marriage to the Irish Catholic Marr. Now, he eventually relented and granted his permission, disinheriting his daughter. He granted the couple a place to live while they were in New York, but she was written out of the will for her choice to marry Marr. Marr initially set about to make a living as a public speaker, and he commanded enormous speaking fees, earning as much as $1,500 for a single speech, which is approximately $37,182 in 2023 currency. So those are some pretty hefty fees there. And he got licensed to practice law in New York, although that was not really his forte, as just 4 short years after marrying, Lincoln would be elected president and the country would break out in war. And just like the Civil War would tear apart families, some of Marr's former Young Ireland brethren would fight for the South, and they would never speak again. And these were people that were literally, they were exiled to Tasmania with him, made their own escapes, and they were brothers in truth, like in the Henry V, you know, Shakespeare, Henry V, oh, we band of brothers, sort of brothers, right? I mean, maybe they didn't share blood, but the blood of the covenant is thicker than the waters of the womb. And these were his blood brothers by that metric. Now, Marr, while he didn't necessarily have an opinion on slavery, agreed with Lincoln's sentiment that the important thing was to keep the country as the United States. And he set about recruiting the Irish to fight for the Union. And he was successful. He managed to field an entire regiment who were basically wasted and slaughtered wholesale by bad generalship, basically. I mean, the Irish loved McClellan because, hey, McClellan's an Irish name. He was at one point, his family was in Ireland, so he must have been one of them at one point. But McClellan was not a very capable general, and that was explored with the book on the Civil War that I read, Battle Cry of Freedom. Because Marr was a hero of Ireland and an effective public speaker, he mustered the 69th Irish Regiment. The link for the cocktail is in the description, says that after the Battle of Fredericksburg, he wanted to mix up his favorite drink, which was whiskey and Vichy water. Vichy is basically a sparkling water. Since they didn't have sparkling water, they went with champagne, and the regimental cocktail was born. Hence the choice. Fredericksburg was fought in December, so they probably had ice, so I added ice to mine. Now, the Fighting Irish, under Brigadier General Thomas Francis Marr, fought in basically every single engagement of the Army of the Potomac fought in. Which, if you know anything about the Civil War, means basically he fought the whole damn war. He briefly resigned his commission, I think at like the end of 1863. He missed Gettysburg. He wasn't in Gettysburg, but he was in New York when the death sheets started rolling in from that one. Before he was drawn back into the army following the riots in New York City. Now, the riots, if you don't know, were in fact race riots, which started after the Emancipation Proclamation was issued. And the Irish most definitely did not think that they should be spending their blood to free the slaves. Save the nation that gave them harbor during the height of the famine. That was absolutely a bill that Marr was able to sell them on. Free the slaves? Not an easy sell. And Marr's popularity plummeted, and he had a very hard time mustering additional troops after that. Now, as the war reached its conclusion in 1865, Marr and Libby started trying to plan their next move. They could not realistically keep living in her father's residence in New York. I mean, she was able to stay there while Marr was off fighting the war, but once the war was over, they had to come up with something to do because Townsend just wasn't going to let them keep freeloading off of him, basically. So they planned to move west. And Marr went ahead to kind of figure out where exactly they were going to settle, and he could send for her once he had a house in place. And when he was in Minnesota, he received word from the newly sworn-in President Johnson that Johnson had appointed Marr Secretary of the Montana Territory. So he headed to the gold fields of Montana. And on arriving there, Like, he got there just as the governor of Montana said, "Hey, I need to leave. I got to bug out back east. I needed back in wherever the hell he came from. You be the acting governor and peace out." And so Marr became the acting governor of Montana, and that was basically his role for the rest of his life. And that's a problem because he remained a Democrat. I mean, he was invited to join the Republicans there, but he actually remained a Democrat, and a not insignificant portion of the other settlers were Republicans, and violently so. They basically were the early forerunners of the moral majority, if you will. They led multiple lynch mobs in the name of vigilante justice, hanging basically anybody that they just didn't like. And they did not like Marr, who had the audacity to believe that the criminal justice system should apply even in the territory that wasn't a state yet, and that men were innocent until proven guilty. And so when the vigilante crowd had drawn up a, hold on, I think it was Daniels. No, I should have put his name in here. Now I'm gonna have to look it up. Yeah, James Daniels. They had pegged James Daniels as somebody who needed to be executed, and Marr issued the guy a pardon. Said, "No, we're not just going to summarily execute you. You haven't been found guilty of anything. Here's a pardon." The vigilante crowd took exception to that. They did not like Marr stepping outside of the lines they had drawn for him, and they hung the guy anyways, leaving Marr's pardon in his back pocket as kind of a fuck you to the governor. Now, for as awful as things were in Montana, Libby joined Marr there because she was his soulmate. All right, she was his equal in everything. And the last, I think, 2 years of his life was spent exploring the beauty of Montana, and he recommended Yellowstone be made into some sort of national monument. And it would actually become, I think it was the first national park in the world based on his recommendation. In 1867, he and Libby were trying to figure out their next move. And Montana was hostile to the Irish. And Marr had this dream that Montana could be New Ireland, but he was having a hell of a time getting people to leave the tenements of New York. And he really wanted to find a way to see Ireland again. So he and Libby were trying to figure out how they might be able to make that happen. Like, maybe they could get a political pardon from Queen Victoria or something. You know, that it's been, you know, 30 years since he were 27 years since he was arrested and booted out. On July 1st, 1867, he was in Fort Benton to receive a shipment of firearms from General William Tecumseh Sherman, who, while not a fan of Marr's, and he actually kind of hated Marr, recognized the need for firearms in Montana to fight off the hostile Sioux nations. When he was on the steamboat that would have returned him home, Marr disappeared, presumably over the side of the ship, and became one of the mysteries of the Old West. I mean, nobody really knows what happened to him. He just vanished into the Missouri River. The most plausible explanation is that the vigilante crowd, led by Wilbur Sanders, who I think was the district attorney or the attorney general of the state or something like that, had hired an assassin. Because there wasn't a lynch mob that came for Marr. Marr was too well known and entirely too popular to be hung from a tree. He was a likely candidate to be a representative of the territory to the Senate in D.C., so he would not have been easy to just hang high and dry because he was. It was Because he was politically unpopular with the vigilantes. He was also an exceptional swimmer. He grew up swimming the rivers and lakes of Ireland. He kept those skills up in Tasmania and the Missouri River. While it was fast-paced, was not whitewater rapids. He would have been able to swim them easily. And while he definitely enjoyed his whiskey, witnesses at the time all testified that he was not drunk when he retired that evening. So if he had stumbled and fallen overboard, it would have been nothing for him to swim to shore and have a funny anecdote out of it. You know, I tripped over my own shoes and fell overboard, but I swam to shore. Ha ha, isn't that funny? Sanders did try to put it out that he put Marr to bed and Marr was totally drunk and he must have fallen overboard, but literally no other witnesses back that story. An inquest held in 2012, so 140 years after the fact, after he vanished into the Missouri River, determined that he was murdered either directly by or at the behest of Sanders. Now, it's 140 years later. Obviously, we are never going to know if that's actually true. It's the most likely explanation, but it's a mystery. We're never going to know for sure. Maybe he did stumble over his own feet and hit his head on a rock and drowned. The only reason the author doesn't think that so is that people report hearing a cry right around the time he vanished, and then maybe one other shout. So, who knows? All right, and that's why his death is a mystery. Now, Libby returned to New York, where she remained disinherited and lived off her military widow's pension of $50 a month, which is about $1,200 in modern currency. And while Marr never met his son, Libby did, and Thomas Bennett Marr lived with her for a time before heading west. Now, he eventually died in the Philippines in 1909. Libby died July 5th, 1906 at 75. She never remarried after the death of Thomas. And he covers the, you know, I didn't go into all of his compatriots from the Young Ireland movement, but he covers all of them and how they ended up. This book was a wild ride. I mean, it was exceptionally well written. It was very easy to follow. It provided an excellent account of one of the 19th century's true heroes. And he was a man who fought for what was right and gave voice to a people held down by centuries of repression. And it's heartbreaking that he never got to see home again, never got to see his son. It definitely makes me want to get in touch with my local Celtic society and the Daughters of Erin. I mean, I'm Scots-Irish after all. It's the shirt. I mean, any Norse blood in me is by way of Ireland. So, I don't know. It was a good book. And it does make you wonder what did happen. I think it's most likely he was murdered. There's definitely indications that he was scared for his life on the last day that he was in town in Benton. I think he probably was killed, and that's really sad because he was planning on leaving. It was no longer going to be a thorn in their side anyways, but, you know, we'll never know. And that's it for this week. If you like what you saw, don't forget to subscribe, and I will see you guys on next Sunday. Bye.